Welcome to the Net Positive Podcast, a series of podcasts on clean energy and the environment. The Net Positive is about crafting healthy communities and a sustainable world. These explorations are designed to educate and inspire. That's when we get action. This episode features a conversation with Kirk Stokes. He's the Vice President for Business Development for Smart Storage at MBL Energy. We're happy to have him on the show this afternoon. Well, Kirk, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you here with me.
Thank you. I totally appreciate the invite and welcome the opportunity to chat with you as well.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to digging in into microgrids and storage solutions. But before we do that, I've already framed up your credentials. Let's go all the way back to your youth. I think, having looked at your resume, that you were born and raised in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Is that correct?
I'm not surprised you got that impression because we lived in Los Alamos a lot. But I was actually born in Boulder, Colorado. My dad went to CU. He's an engineer from University of Colorado. You've heard the phrase military brats. My siblings and I, I'm the oldest, were national lab brats. My dad moved around a fair amount, Livermore, Nevada Test Site, Los Alamos, Sandia. When we were growing up, he ended up spending the most time. And in effect, I graduated from Los Alamos High School a long time ago.
Right. And then you flowed right into New Mexico State University for your undergraduate degree?
It was a long and winding road even through my undergrad, really trying to figure out. I could always do the math. I was always good at problem solving and I was good at math. And my dad was an engineer and he kind of encouraged the engineering path. But because the way I was raised, we spent a lot of time outdoors. We were outdoor enthusiasts. I don't think my dad would have described himself as an environmentalist at the time, back in that day. But that's what he raised. He raised an engineer. An engineering brain with an environmentalist heart. You know, so I was looking for a path to use my engineering early on. And it led me to, eventually it led me to New Mexico State. I did the first couple years of college elsewhere.
So you were looking for a way of applying that engineering. What did you, like when you were a kid, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
You know, we were mostly, the career was not really so much a focus when I was growing up, as we had a lot of fun. We were moving. We were out. We were spending a lot of time outdoors. We were athletic. We liked team sports. We liked individual sports. There was a lot of activities in our life as our family moved around. We were very, very close and remain a very close family. And really, the turning point for me, I just didn't think about it much. My dad encouraged me to go to engineering school. And really, there were a couple moments in that early phase of engineering where I kind of decided that clean energy was the path I wanted to get on.
And that was about what year would you say? 1970?
78, 79. There were two, my sophomore year of college before I took a year and a half off, and longer story there, but there were two things that happened in my sophomore year. One was I had a thermodynamics professor who was building a passive solar home. And he kept using examples of thermodynamics and heat transfer in the context of his solar home design. So I was like, okay, here's a way to apply this engineering background to thermo. And another thing that happened, you have, the RMI in your background, Rocky Mountain Institute in your background, a good friend that wasn't an engineer, but was an environmentalist, you know, we had a connection that way, gave me a soft energy path, that book in my sophomore year of college. And so that was 78. And that was, you know, those two kind of factors is what I think of when I think back to kind of like trying to figure out how to apply what my brain could do in a way that I had a passion about.
I love the fact that you brought that up, Kirk. I just had dinner with Amory a couple weeks ago in Colorado. We actually had a couple evenings with him, but at dinner, I was getting a little mushy and I was talking about soft energy paths. I was talking about how he had really influenced a generation of us. We were motivated by this guy that saw that I was in the anti-nuclear movement. And here was this guy talking about these terrific solutions that were distributed and clean and could really bring us great benefits as a society.
Totally. And my another little anecdote for me is my dad, who is a huge influence on my life in all sorts of ways. He was at Los Alamos. This is where he ended up retiring at Los Alamos Labs. I graduated from there. He was still living there for the next 20 years. He did. Los Alamos had this reputation, still does. It's a nuclear weapons lab. They focus on nuclear energy, nuclear weapons. But there was a lot of innovative solar energy thinking. A fellow named Doug Palcom, who you probably know, was a Los Alamos lab. He ran a division at Los Alamos Lab that was doing a lot of passive solar work and kind of thinking about building design, building energy systems. And my dad was a total geek about that stuff. And he designed his own passive solar home modeled after Doug Balcom's home that I took off after my sophomore year. My brother and I took a year and a half off and helped my dad build this house. We did owner builder kind of a passive solar home in Los Alamos. And that was another moment that's like, I was sure that when I was done and ready to go back to school, that clean energy and that soft energy path, whatever form it took, was the path I wanted to be on.
And then you formed, is it Altair Energy? Was that your first solar company?
It was. My first solar job was working as a contractor. This is out of the Colorado State University Solar Mechanical Engineering Department in the late 80s, had a solar energy division, solar energy lab that the ME department ran, got my master's there. And I went to Las Cruces, back to New Mexico State. And they were a contractor to Sandia Labs at the time. Sandia was developing the first solar PV production models, PV form it was called back in the day, that became the basis for a lot of the solar production modeling that occurs even today. And they needed data. They needed performance modeling data. So I went and worked for New Mexico State. They were one of three research stations nationally. One was at MIT Lincoln Lab, one was in Central Florida, and one was at New Mexico State. And that was my first solar job. I spent 5 years there before then moving to Colorado and then fast forwarding a few years, starting Altair Energy as a design build. I was sure I wanted to apply what I learned, not research it. So that was the genesis of Altair Energy in the late 90s.
And so those, you were putting in some of the early solar systems for largely residential at the time?
Right. We had a contract. What launched, we got an angel investor, and what launched Altair Energy was, one, this angel investor was the owner and founder of Advanced Energy up in Fort Collins, Doug Schatz, who happened to be interested in power conditioning for solar systems. And he wanted to, you know, be involved with a bunch of young engineering oriented guys. So he was our angel investor, and we had a contract with Xcel Energy. The consulting work I'd done prior to Altair was largely consulting to utilities, kind of educating about clean energy, about solar. And we did the first we ran Xcel's net metering program in the late 90s. And we did probably the first 100 grid tied systems in Colorado. We also ran Xcel Energy Solar for School program then. We did 30 Solar for School projects, including Carbondale, back in the day. So that's what paid the bills. We had a contract with Xcel at the time that was early stage pilot net metering program, really, that was kind of in the same, at the time, about the same kind of genre as some of the innovative stuff that was going on in California too.
And so you were definitely on rooftop. You were installing at the time.
We were installing, and we installed, like I said, 75-ish, some of the first net metered grid interactive, grid connected solar systems, all homes, or these really small systems as pilots on schools. But we were an EPC. We were one of the first solar EPCs, probably nationally. There weren't many of us around at the time that were actually designing, building, and installing, selling solar systems for homes.
So. And then we won't go through all the steps, but Altair, and then Sundance Power System, then Solar Power, and then Golden Power. You had all these different jobs, just building your resume of installations and projects.
The solar coaster. I didn't coin the phrase, but it's so true. You know, through lots of merger, acquisition, new business startup, you know, it's really been a 20 years of new business and new product development work that I think I must like it. I like solving problems. I like solving puzzles. I like doing things new. And so I've kind of been on that leading edge of trying to introduce these new systems and new businesses into the space.
So it's got to be pretty rewarding when you look back on your history here, or your career, and you see that solar has just gone from this very nascent position. I remember Don Osborne at SMUD, you know, if we could only be producing 60 megawatts a year globally, that would be wouldn't that be great? And now, of course, you know, it's just off the charts and some of the cheapest power on the market.
So. Oh, totally true. And it's totally rewarding, totally satisfying. I joke with my wife that there's a real industry out there. There's a reason that I'm working with a bunch of, you know, 30 somethings, maybe the old, you know, some of the older ones might be 40, but there's a real industry out there that's drawing now, you know, expertise in the next generation of minds into this industry. And that's, you know, to have played a small part in that, it is satisfying for sure.
Yeah, it's really great. I just did an interview with Dennis Hayes, largely considered the founder of Earth Day, and talked about the whole environmental movement and what sort of came together in 1972, and how important that has been for all of the clean technologies and the reforms that have been going on. But you mentioned problem solving, and that's clearly why you went towards storage. I always think of energy storage as being sort of the next quantum leap, or the next step in complexity from solar alone. But did you go directly to was it Sharp's Smart Energy or Smart Storage? Was that your first sort of real focus on storage and microgrids?
Yeah, you know, the quick anecdote is those projects I mentioned for Xcel Energy back in the early days, they had batteries in them also, and they were actually resilient systems. They had trace inverters. They didn't have sophisticated software. They had a manual transfer switch, but we would always create a critical load subpanel. These were Foothills communities, Evergreen, you know, the Front Range area, communities that had occasional outages and they wanted solar. So fast forward, you know, really to 2012, I left the solar only world that I was in and joined Sharp Labs of America because they needed a solar guy on their team. They were a bunch of analytical software development guys that were focused on, they had this, because Sharp had a solar division, they certainly understand the value of adding storage to solar systems, dispatchable solar, in effect. You know, that's what storage does for a solar system. It gives you the ability to automate and control the ebb and flow of a resource that typically is only controlled by the sun. But so I joined Sharp in 2012, and we really started and founded that product, the smart storage product, in subsequent years that, you know, now has been rolling out and adding new features, adding new ways to add, to deliver economic benefits, as you know. And now we're getting to the point, the segue into the microgrid world of, in addition to normal grid-tied operation present and deliver bill savings to customers, we're now able to stack and operate the system during an outage for that resiliency benefit as well.
Pretty great. I want to really dig into sort of interconnection issues, but and how utilities are responding to this. But you and I really, we'd met, but we really got to know each other because of the Santa Rita Union School District story, or that project, which
right. The
motion that developed with the school, for the school district, and we created 6 microgrids there. And it seemed like everything that could go wrong maybe not. Maybe that's an overstatement. It was just you ended up taking the project. The concept was beautiful. The financing was wonderful. The construction was fantastic. But you ended up taking the project and getting it from a bunch of equipment on the site to getting it fully interconnected with the grid. And what were the key issues that made that so lengthy, that process?
You know, and it's always 2020 hindsight, but I put Santa Rita, and we're Santa Rita is now operating. It's in the mode right now. Fast forward a few years, we are operating it as of today. We're operating the microgrids with kind of a new software platform. But aside from that, what we learned in hindsight was not everything went wrong, but we learned a lot of lessons that we will try not to repeat doing it the same way in the future. And a simple way of describing it is the solar industry spent 10 years getting utilities collaborative at some level, but getting utilities comfortable that when an outage occurs, these UL listed solar inverters and then solar plus storage inverters that would deliver grid tied benefits would turn off immediately when the outage occurs, so that there's no risk to utility linemen repairing the outage that they would incur a shock. So the utilities, rightfully so, are really concerned about backfeed. When they think their system's down and they're trying to repair it, they do not want these distributed resources to be backfeeding. So we spent a lot of years in the industry with these grid interactive inverters and getting utilities comfortable that they will turn off the way they're supposed to turn off. Now you enter the picture where we're introducing a new generator. That's really what we're doing. The genset, the engine generator world has been around forever. And utilities are comfortable with that operation too, that when the auto transfer switch in a genset system, the grid goes out, the ATS starts the generator, utilities are comfortable that ATS is not going to allow backfeeding to the grid. Our generator is different. The solar plus storage generator, they can operate both grid tied in outage mode. And now at Santa Rita, we opened a Pandora's box with interconnection issues with utility that hasn't been opened very often with behind the meter systems. And what we learned was utilities are still hyper concerned, as they should be, that this new technology coupled with storage that can operate in an outage and can operate the solar system in an outage, now they have this concern that of backfeed. And so they sent us through a 12-month ordeal to get our hardware and our software certified, site certified, so that to guarantee to them that it wouldn't backfeed when we went into outage mode.
Right.
12 months. That was a minimum. It was a 12 to 15 month process. It was an ordeal.
A really good description of an understanding of utilities' lack of comfort, or just that it takes time to get comfortable with. As you said, they're comfortable with the automatic transfer switches on the gensets. If you have an automatic transfer switch on a microgrid, then theoretically, you're good, right?
That's correct. The catch is though, we have the utilities have specific DG relays and third party consultants to make sure that when you put a microgrid in place, that you're putting the right equipment and the right software as reviewed by a third party independent engineer that we had to hire at Santa Rita. So it became this ordeal of they had to program instead of the ATS, there was this relay. And what we learned from Santa Rita was avoid the utility approved relay and their third party consultants and operate your system, engineer your system behind an ATS, behind a UL listed ATS. There's it's never easy. There's limitations on what you can do with the ATS in terms of the actual site specifics, but at least it streamlines the interconnection process and it makes the HJs comfortable, the inspectors comfortable that you have a UL listed device that's in effect the master controller that prevents that backfeeding, like you said.
Right. So now that was several years ago. Do you think that PG&E and Edison and other utilities now are gaining this comfort there's lots of microgrids being developed in the state of California, I guess across the country as well.
You know, I will say I participated in a California Public Utilities Commission meeting right before COVID, early 2020, late 2019. There's a working group that was looking at microgrids. And the main lesson I took away from that, and that's really about a year and a half after Santa Rita, was that people trying to develop microgrids are hitting the same barriers. It's the, and the company we're working with now that just got a permission to operate on a microgrid system in Central California, literally it still took them 12 months to get the microgrid permission to operate from the utility. So, you know, I'm hopeful. These things take time. The cartoon I had on my wall at Altair Energies was a frog halfway buried inside a crane's mouth, with the frog had its hands around the crane's neck, and the caption was "Never give up." So, you know, you have to keep working at it, and you have to be, you know, find ways to deliver the solution. And I think the Santa Rita lessons learned, and the kind of this hybrid of learning what the genset does to make the utilities comfortable, learning what not to do at Santa Rita, has created a solution that we started to create at Nant Energy, and now MBL Energy is finishing the solution with our microgrid team, that we think we are confident we can operate these microgrids. That's what's happened at Santa Rita now, really behind a UL listed ATS in most situations.
Right, and I'm hoping, Kirk, and I know this is going to sound a little bit too far out there for you, but I'm hoping that the utilities will shortly embrace microgrids as, you know, as generators on their system that will improve the resilience of the whole system, and that there's a real value in having all these microgrids that are ready to spring into action and to provide these benefits. With the PSPS events, obviously the utilities are deploying generators and, you know, crazy strategies like that, which only exacerbates the climate problems that have whipped up the wildfires that have caused the PSPS events in the first place. But do you think that we'll get to a point where there will be a happy marriage between macrogrid and microgrids?
I believe so. I think the large forces at play are PSPS events, like you're saying, and climate change. And I think the utilities and the regulators in particular, like what happened, the analogy for me, it's deja, so many deja vu moments in the storage, adding storage to the solar world from the early solar days, that some of the lessons, some of the path that we're on to add storage to solar systems is analogous. It's similar in many ways to the learning curve that utilities are on, and just rightly being concerned about backfeed, and not trusting everyone that everyone's going to do the software right to prevent backfeeding. So you need to have these standardized solutions. Once you get to a standardized solution, like what happened in the solar world, you get expedited interconnection agreements. You get these expedited approval processes, even NEM paired storage, the net metered solar plus storage, now has an expedited interconnection process because of the UL listed inverters. I think we'll get there with microgrids eventually. It really has to really mushroom into the kind of market-based solution rather than these early market solutions that we've been delivering into the market. But I think it has to, you have to come up with these standardized solutions.
Yeah, that's true. And you mentioned the NEM, the net energy metering paired with storage. You know, I guess in the old days, only 5 years ago, you couldn't discharge your batteries into the grid. And now if you power those batteries 100% with solar, at least for the investor-owned utilities in California, you can discharge excess capacity back into the grid.
By CPUC regulation, the answer is yes. Practically speaking, on a project-by-project basis where the utility, again, doesn't have standardized methods for accepting non-export software, practically speaking, it doesn't exist yet from my perspective. Because the again, you get into this, there is a CPUC ruling that says that's true. And we all of our kilowatt hours into the batteries are from solar, and the discharge between 4 and 9 does the grid some good, but we still are capped by the site load. We can't export because the software, the protocols from the utilities perspective to approve those non-export mechanisms, the software mechanisms, they don't exist. And believe me, the industry is asking the question and looking hard for standardized approval processes so that the interconnection, again, the interconnection process can be streamlined, but that it just takes time for these things to filter down into the actual practical world.
Are you following any of these microgrid tariff proceedings?
Not closely.
I'm just puzzled by it. I guess California has created a microgrid rule, and at least the first phase of it, and Hawaii has also. And I think it's just a challenge. The challenge is to try to figure out what should the tariff be. And I see Hawaii Electric Company has responded by saying, well, we should charge all microgrids $5 a kW per year and just have a fee for them to be able to interact with the utility, sort of like what's happening with net energy metered solar. The utilities are wanting to slap on monthly fees. But the regulators are trying to say, wait a second. Yes, there's challenges to interconnecting microgrids, but aren't there benefits as well? And so I know in Hawaii, phase two of their microgrid tariff proceeding is to try to identify what the benefits are. And, you know, maybe when we're developing microgrids, Kirk, it's such a game. We're trying to finance them. And as you know, we're trying to pick up the investment tax credit for solar and the depreciation benefits. And we're trying to get the ITC for storage. And we're trying to get the SCHIP, the self-generation incentive program incentives for the batteries. And there's different tiers of that, as you know. And then net energy metering is sort of in flux as to what the value will be. But it seems to me that when we're developing these systems, we're trying to cobble together from all these sort of different incentives that were not intended for microgrids at all. And so it's, I don't have any of the answers, but I think it'll be interesting in the coming years to see how regulators balance the challenge that utilities have with interconnecting microgrids with the benefits that microgrids provide to society. And of course, it's very much like the net energy metering rules. I think if the utilities prevail and have fees that are too expensive for microgrids, then people will just go off the grid altogether, right? I mean, we're kind of at a point now where the price of solar coming down, the price of batteries coming down so fast that, you know, people can defect from the grid, or companies will make that choice if the regulators don't get the tariffs right.
Yeah, and it does seem, you know, the analogy again to solar is every time a solar system goes in, that's revenue lost from the utility. That meter and that kWh is lost revenue to the utility. So that's why they've fought NEM rules forever, and we're still evolving. And to me, microgrids are different in terms of the ability of the microgrid. I think solves a problem for the utility, doesn't create a problem, doesn't create lost revenue. It solves the problem of reliability and the grid having weak points and being affected by wind events and fire events. To me, I think microgrids ought to have more of the utilities ought to be more advocates of the microgrids. I have that hope, actually, that I think that could be their perspective, is that the microgrid operation of a normally grid-tied system can deliver benefits that are mutually beneficial between the customer and the utility because it solves a problem.
Right. And I've always been an advocate that the utilities should have been in the solar business. If people want solar, sell them solar. And because we didn't do that, all sorts of EPCs, all sorts of solar companies developed and created a lot of lost revenues for the utility. Same thing, I was gonna ask you this question, but do you think that utilities ought to get into the microgrid space and be actually providing microgrids to customers, selling microgrid services, selling the resiliency that comes with microgrids?
You know, they're, I think they were a natural leader. And I think they lost that opportunity a long time ago. I don't think energy services, you know, with the fact is a solar plus storage generator delivers benefit to the customer at a lower price than the utility is selling them electricity. And that solar plus storage generator can deliver resiliency to that customer. It seems like the deregulation genie is out of the bottle, and the utilities are going to become wires companies. They're going to be the company that has to collect their fees by delivering kilowatt hours across the wires and the services. I don't know how it'll play out, but I think the utilities in many cases lost that opportunity a long time ago.
So they're seeing that part of their business diminish, but then they're seeing all the new kilowatt hour sales from electric vehicles and the electrification of buildings as sort of being there where they grow now. They're losing certain functions,
right,
and growing in other areas. But it certainly seemed to me that, and maybe it is too late, but maybe not. Maybe municipal utilities. I'm working now as on the Glendale Water and Power Commission. We're a municipal utility here in Glendale. We're building a virtual power plant, and you know, maybe we would have some customers that would like microgrids, and that we could get behind that and demonstrate how a utility could own, operate a microgrid and provide that resiliency service for customers for a fee and be in business.
Right. No, I think it seems reasonable. I mean, if a utility that hasn't been dragging their feet and been regulated, and the public power sector hasn't been rate regulated forever, still isn't for the most part, there's still opportunity, probably, like these munis, the cities that are all requirements customers of DWP or however that plays out in LA. Some of my first consulting work was with the power marketing agencies, WAPA and BPA and all those sorts of guys. So there, I think there's still opportunity if the municipality and the public power entity is innovative enough in their thinking.
And then so sort of another big picture question is like, how many microgrids will we have, you know, in the future? I mean, will it be common? Will there be a microgrid, many microgrids in every community? Or, it just seems like the way the economics are going, like you said, you can self-generate, store your power, have resiliency at a lower cost than buying from the grid. So this seems like it could be I don't want to say a runaway train, because I think it's a very good thing.
Well, and it's also, to me, having spent a fair amount of my early career thinking about off-grid solar, as soon as you don't have the grid to lean on for reliability, for energy services when the solar and storage system can't deliver it, that's a big threshold to cross. So the utilities still have a massive, even if they're just a wires company, that's an understatement to say just, because it's really important, you know, that if they could figure out a business model that they could benefit as well as their customers benefit by self-generating, that dependency on those wires and kind of that, the price signals from utilities to don't overproduce in the middle of the day, push your generation to between 4 and 9 p.m. period, those distributed generators could actually be, could help the utility operate its grid, I think. Without completely disconnecting, because that's a big, big step for a customer to take to disconnect completely.
It is a big step. I guess Stone Edge Farms up in Mendocino has been operating independent of the grid for about a year now. But that's very experimental, and they put a lot of money into that. I want to talk just about a couple of your coolest projects, because we worked together when you were at Sharp. Then Sharp was bought by Nant Energy, and then Nant Energy sold your division to MBL Energy. What are some of the coolest projects that you're working on right now?
Well, and you and I have talked about this. The program that we're most excited about right now is working with Marin Clean Energy up in Napa, you know, up in Marin, Napa, and those North Bay counties that Marin MCE serves, as you know, in your work with CPA and others, now East Bay, it sounds like. That's an incredibly innovative and really interesting business model. From MCE's perspective, they're delivering behind the meter benefits to their customers, but there's a benefit and an incentive for them to encourage customers to move solar kilowatt hours and through battery charging and discharging to that 4 to 9 p.m. period. And that helps their resource adequacy charges, offsets some of those charges from the utility. That's an incredibly innovative and exciting business model. That's kind of what the way I think about it. So we're working with a lot of MCE customers to put both, you know, the whole solar world out there, because of the history we just talked about, solar systems turn off when there's an outage. They just do. That's the way they were designed, not to backfeed. What we're doing is we're bringing storage into existing solar sites under this MCE program and re-energizing them, re-engineering them, so that the solar system can stay on during the outage with the help of this storage system. Now, we're doing new solar plus storage projects for schools and Marin County and Napa County. So that's a really exciting initiative from my perspective.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you brought that up again. And the this whole notion of the stacked benefits, you know, the battery being an expensive asset, and you want to use it for not just sitting there for when the grid goes down, but you want to use it for energy arbitrage and peak clipping. And here's an example of a CCA using it for an ancillary service, is the resource adequacy that we talked about.
And you're exactly right. You've heard this from me before, that you know, we focus on the economics of grid tied operation first, and inherent in those positive economics now that you get a payback in a reasonable period of time, and you're also buying resiliency with the same investment. Now you're buying that extra resiliency stack, as you said very well. So it's an exciting time, and storage is really precipitating that change and that dynamic in the solar world.
What are you doing, like, personally? You mentioned you've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing it for a long time. You're a healthy guy. What are you doing to keep balance in your life, to keep stress tamped down, or are you faking it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've always been, like I said, an outdoor enthusiast. I love being outside. I exercise regularly. I'm a river rafting nut. I love to get on white water, but mostly just get on the river, get in the backcountry, let the river wash my thoughts clean. I'm going to be with three of my sons. We're going to be doing a four day, three night fly fishing trip on the Upper Colorado here later this month. So, balance in my life has always been, I've loved being a dad. I've loved the work I've done, but balance has always been important to stay healthy along the way. So hope to be doing it for a long time still.
Right on. Well, you're doing great. Thank you for all you've done and for all that you will do. And for EcoMotion, you've been a great friend, and you've also been a great source of technical advice for us. So we really appreciate that. So thanks so much for being on the Net Positive with me. I think people will be fascinated by your comments, and we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you, Ted. I appreciate the time. And as always, it's fun to talk with you, and I look forward to the next conversation as well.
Very good. Maybe it'll be out on the river.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, Kirk.
Take care.
That's it. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Net Positive. We'll see you next time.